Good morning again. If you're a 9:15er, good morning. If you're an 11:15er. There is a torrent of information about what's happening in the world of religion. Our purpose in this program is to look at just enough of that torrent to provide a context for a longer conversation about our mission as a religious movement. And when I say our mission in this program, the hour I'm talking about is all you use rather than just W you use. So that's the context for this morning. I hope that longer conversation can integrate three things. The first is our values. The second is what the world needs to move toward those values. And the third is a match between those needs and the particular gifts that Unitarian Universalists bring, as best we can judge those. This, to me, is what religious mission means, is that triangle of things to be integrated. Today, we're going to look at some aerial photographs of religion. Next week, we'll look at the prevailing interpretations of what those photographs mean. In the third session, we're going to try to connect those meanings to what we think our mission should be. There are three lenses for today's look. First, a geographical one, concentrating on the United States, but also seeing the rest of the world as an important context. Second, a chronological one, looking at both the present and at historical trends that have brought us to where we are. And third, a qualitative one that includes a saying part about the religions people identify themselves with when they're asked, and a doing part about how they participate in religious activity. You should each have a set of copies of the PowerPoint screens for this first session. My presentation is going to last 20 to 25 minutes, which will leave about the same amount of time for discussion and questions. To finish on time, we need to hold questions till then. So fasten your seatbelts. This is going to go quick. We begin with what people are saying when they are asked what religion, if any, they identify themselves as part of. Keep identification distinct in your minds from participation, including that form of participation called membership. Screen 2 is a present tense snapshot of religious identification in the United States. It reflects a major study surveying over 35,000 people, completed just a few months ago by the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, a very prestigious study organization for sociology of religion. Most of us in America, as you can see, identify ourselves as Christian. Screen 3 shows that most of the Christians are Protestant and that a plurality of the Protestants are evangelical, with that group being nearly 50% larger than the next one. The remainder of our country's diversity in organized religion is depicted in screen 4. And since our subject is our place in the world of religion, you'll notice I've pulled us up out of the anonymity of other faiths at the bottom of the column. We represent 0.3% of the country. This would be a good time to remember that old saying that it's not the size of the dog in the fight, but the size of the fight in the dog. Right, Fred? Good. Yeah. Not all of America's religious diversity is organized. That doesn't mean it's disorganized. It means it's just unorganized. And screen 5 shows the unorganized portion, which is called unaffiliated. This segment of the population turns out to be significant, all out of proportion to its absolute numbers, as we're going to see in a few minutes. So that's the U.S. picture, aerial photograph style. A companion snapshot for religious identification. We're not talking about participation yet, just identification. On a worldwide basis is shown in screen 6. The world is not mostly Christian, but Christianity is a large plurality of it. Notice that 4 of the 14 religious groups pictured here account for 90% of the population. One of those groups is labeled atheism, which also shows up in the unaffiliated section of the U.S. picture that we saw a moment ago. One wag, certainly no friend of atheism, once said that calling atheism a religion is like calling baldness a hair color. And it's a funny joke, but to many of us, atheistic doesn't mean anti-theistic, nor does it mean a-spiritual or anti-spiritual. So those are important distinctions to keep in mind. We won't spend a lot of time in international waters this morning, but the relevance of this international picture will come into sharp focus next week in the second session. Turning to the trends underlying these snapshots of religious identification to see where we came to get where we are today, I want to show you four highlights. First, in the last 30 years, the percentage of the population that identifies itself as Protestant has declined from 65 to 51%. That means, if you do this math, that Protestantism has lost over 20% of its followership over that period of time. American Protestants are about to find out, finally, what it's like to be a minority. Important shift in our country. Second, if we look within Protestantism, we see that this 20% decline is actually an average of three distinct trends. Evangelical Protestant churches have been growing, although at least one very distinguished sociologist of religion, Robert Wuchnow, sees that growth as leveling off. Mainline Protestant churches have been declining at a rate greater than 20%, because 20% is the average, and the evangelical ones have been increasing somewhat. And historically, black churches have remained about the same. There will be handouts in the second and third sessions that fill you in on how these groups were defined, and will give you narrative descriptions of how they're constituted. So that'll be helpful, I think, to have. The third highlight is that even though Catholicism's share of the U.S. population has held steady at about 24% for 30 years, it is a religion in decline. And screen 7 shows why. The 24% share represents the net result of losses and gains in followership. Nearly a third of the respondents to the Pew Forum study said they were raised Catholic. That's nearly a third of the adults in the United States, is what that's saying. 10% of them, though, said they had left the Catholic Church as adults. So if you do the 10%, 31% math, you can see that Catholicism lost a third of its American followership in the last generation or two. That's a very, very big loss. These losses were partially offset by new arrivals. That's the 4% on screen 7. The last two lines of screen 7 show where the new arrivals are coming from. Immigration. The 4% intake represents an equivalent outflow of Catholics in the home countries of those immigrants. Now, my point is not to make a value judgment about that either way, but simply to say, if I were assessing a religion as a church consultant, for example, I would call that a not very sustainable foundation for a church, because it's very dependent on a continued influx of immigrants, and it's not really any net gain in the religion worldwide. So this is really a picture of decline. The fourth highlight I want to give you on this is that in order to drum up attendance this morning, in Thursday's spiral, I posed a riddle about which U.S. religious group is growing the fastest. Don't know if you saw that. I teasingly hinted that its name started with A-U. Within hours, Tamara Aleem Durden figured out that the answer is unaffiliated. That really wasn't fair, was it? If we look at screen 5 again, which is repeated in your packet as screen 8, just for your convenience, that 16.9% share was somewhere between 5 and 8% 30 years ago. So it has doubled or tripled, and other studies along the way during that 30 years have suggested the number may actually be even larger. Now, consistent with what I said a minute ago about atheism, it would be a mistake to treat this entire group as anti-spiritual, especially notice the subgroup called religious unaffiliated. So this is a heterogeneous group. But the sharp rise in the unaffiliated category does suggest that organized religion as a whole is declining in the United States. The country is moving toward secularism, if you look at these trends. Once again, since our subject is our place in the world of religion, I've tried to put Unitarian Universalism into this picture. And as shown in screen 9, do I have that number right? Yes, I do. You can see in screen 9, we're there with a percentage shown for our part in the overall landscape. Our situation is not as bad as those of the Catholic Church or mainline Protestant churches. The absolute number of people who self-identify as Unitarian Universalists is growing, albeit very slowly. But if we look at ourselves on the same basis as the Pew Forum study portrays the other U.S. religions, in terms of percentages of the population as a whole, we're growing at a rate that is only about one-fifth, 6% versus 1.3, and the 6% is a rounded down number. So we're growing at a rate that's only about one-fifth of the national population growth rate. So I think it's really hard to avoid the conclusion that in the important relevant sense here, we're declining a little bit. As for the worldwide situation, I couldn't find sociological studies that would show what the trend in religious identification has been over a long period of time. The sources I consulted did include some studies on what has happened to participation in religion outside the U.S. as contrasted from mere identification with a particular religion. Again, the difference between, oh yeah, I'm a Presbyterian and I actually go 3 times a month, that kind of difference between identification and participation. So let's turn now to participation and that part of the picture. Screen 10 lists the 6 forms of participation in religion that were included in the recent Pew Forum study. Now, it would be very easy to pick apart this list of 6 and say, well, gee, there are a lot of different ways to participate in religion. These are the 6 that they chose to study. It's a fairly conventional set of measures, and we can take it for what it's worth as that, recognizing that we might make up a different list of forms of participation. From the listings of about 15 religions that we saw at the beginning of my presentation in screens 2 through 5, screen 10 picks out 2 groups of 4 religious groups that consistently bunch up at the low and high ends of these forms of participation. This is a present tense snapshot of religious participation. And in our second session, we're going to explore some possible explanations for this pattern. Why are those churches on that end? Why are these churches on this end? What do the 2 groups have in common? Questions like that. Once again, I've tried to place UUs on this map of religion. Screen 11 picks out 1 form of participation, the act of joining a church. For the churches on the high end of this continuum, 3/4 or more of those who identify with these religions are actually members of those churches. For the churches on the low end, the percentage averages more like 1/3. UUs are in there, as you can see, at 35%. To get us on the map at all, I had to deal with the fact that we're too small to show up separately in the big surveys in terms of frequency of church attendance and other things on that list of 6 that we saw a moment ago. But we do at least have information on how many Americans have self-identified in religious surveys as UUs. And we can compare that to UUA membership figures and therefore include this in the comparison. Now, I think it's important to just pause here for a second and acknowledge that it wouldn't be hard for us to get our backs up a bit looking at these figures. You certainly could ask yourself, how much of that high participation behavior in some of the evangelical churches would be something that you and I might call kind of rote behavior, something like that? Who's to say that those folks have more spiritual depth than people in the religions on the low end of this participation spectrum? Well, in my view, nobody has a right to say that, certainly not without a deeper look at what explains these differences. Sociologists always face a struggle to get nuanced meaning out of statistics, but that doesn't mean that the sociology is worthless. It just means you have to recognize the limitations. And at this point, I just want to ask you to note the patterns, and then next week we'll get into the whys and wherefores underlying those patterns. Looking outside the United States, now we're still talking about participation. We see another interesting pattern in religious participation. Screen 12 shows three forms of religious participation in three groupings of countries. I think the progression in the numbers is pretty obvious. The more commercially highly developed a country is, the lower its level of religious participation. Once again, the interesting question is why this pattern? And do the reasons have something to tell us about religion here in the United States? So that's what we have as a present tense snapshot of religious participation. Now, for this subject, we want to do what we did with religious identification, which is look at the historical trends that got us here. And this time, let's start with the picture outside the U.S. Screen 13 is about religious participation over a 28-year period in seven European countries. As you can see, the declines are dramatic. In three of the seven, the churches lost three-quarters of their attendance. In another, nearly half. And even the two countries with the smallest declines lost nearly a third. Now, a limitation on our understanding of the worldwide trend is that sociological studies of religion in developing countries were pretty rare 30 years ago. So for those countries, we don't have the nice, crisp, longitudinal picture we see in screen 13 for Europe. All of the countries shown here were industrialized or even post-industrial by 1970. So even though it's a useful picture and the changes are very dramatic, it's an incomplete picture in terms of what's happening in the entire world outside the United States. As for the U.S., the picture is not so clear as in Europe. Sociologists of religion have tended to think of the U.S. as a major exception to the overall declining pattern of religious participation in post-industrial countries, in the commercially highly developed ones. The Gallup poll first measured religious participation in the U.S. in 1939, reporting that 40% of Americans had gone to church the previous week. Gallup reported exactly the same figure in 2003. Exactly, 40%. Some studies have suggested that reports of religious participation have been consistently exaggerated in the U.S. due to a social desirability bias concerning church attendance in American culture. In particular, the Gallup poll surveys have been criticized as lacking what the sociologists call social desirability filters, so that the questions asked may have, to some degree, prompted respondents to give affirmative answers to questions about religious participation. Other polls have suggested, other than Gallup, that weekly church attendance in the U.S. has been at a level more like 25% than 40% for some decades now. Polls that changed the sequence of the questions to avoid suggesting the desirability of church attendance found that the number of respondents saying they never go to church jumped from 12 to 33%. As shown in screen 14, the U.S. General Social Survey, a survey that's repeated every few years at a time and is thought to be very reliable, found church attendance to have dropped by about a third in the last 30 years in the United States, while the number who do not attend at all has doubled. I couldn't find studies of the trends in church participation on a religion-by-religion basis, at least not any large visible ones. But the figures we saw at the beginning on what portions of the U.S. population identify with various religions would tend to suggest that the overall decline probably represents an average of some modest gains in the evangelical churches and some even bigger declines in the mainline Protestant churches and in the Catholic churches once we factor in the influence of immigration. So, there's an old Chinese proverb that says, if you continue in the direction you're heading, you're likely to get where you're going. A good way to test that wisdom in this situation is to look at how the attitudes and behavior of young adults compare to those of the general population. The young adults are, after all, the future. Recall that unaffiliated is the fastest growing category of religious identification in America. Screen 15 sorts by age the groups who identify themselves as affiliated with a religion and as unaffiliated. One quarter of the 18 to 29 age group in the U.S. call themselves unaffiliated. For the 30 and over age group, that percentage is only half that. So the difference between 25% and 12.5% might not look too big until you appreciate that it represents, in essence, a doubling of the proportion from the senior age group into the younger one. Looking at religious participation, as contrasted, again, from identification, we see a similar trend shown in screen 16. The young adult group is on the low end of three measures of religious participation that the Pew study looked at in relation to age groups. The over 65 age group is on the high end. Finally, looking at religious participation on a worldwide basis, screen 17 shows that in post-industrial countries, like the U.S., church attendance among young adults is less than half that of seniors, once again indicating, given that those people are the future, that the future trend is likely to be a declining pattern of religious participation, based at least on the sociological data. One of the things we'll talk about next week is whether the sociological data is the whole sum and substance of the picture, and if not, what else? The information in screen 17 is important for two more reasons. The first is that it shows that differences in church attendance between young and old really can't be explained away very effectively by simply saying, well, people have always gotten more religious as they get older. It's kind of intuitive, but the data don't really support that. In the agrarian countries, it obviously isn't so. The level of participation from the youngest age group to the oldest is really pretty steady. There's something distinctive, I think, happening to religious participation among the current crop of young adults in the United States. Something different. And there are different patterns here in the correlations between age and religious participation in the agrarian societies and in the industrial and post-industrial ones. So once again, we have to ask, what accounts for this pattern? And what might the explanation tell us about religion here in the United States? Jennifer, can you hit the no-show button at this point? Sorry? Oh, I'm sorry. We brought number 18 back, right? Yeah. And this was simply to show you, bring it back so you could see this question about what the patterns are and what the correlations are. This is one of the key questions we'll be looking at next week, is what explains the way these groups sort into these baskets when the sociological studies do their polling and then correlate religious identification and participation with the various groups. So what do all these numbers add up to? I said it would be a very quick trip through the high grass. I said it would be an aerial photograph. And there it is. One pattern I see in these numbers is a kind of polarization. The groups on either end of these spectrums, from what the sociologists would call very religious to very secular, whatever we think of those definitions, but the sociologists would say, here are religions that have a lot of participation and a lot of attendance and a lot of identification. So the groups on either end, from religious to secular, in terms of frequency and intensity of the spiritual practices that were studied, are growing or at least holding their own. The ones in the middle, like mainline Protestantism and Catholicism in particular, are declining. So it's appropriate to ask, why the polarization? And what do the groups on either end of it have in common? Why do we find one set of the religious groups on one side of the spectrum and on almost all of these participation criteria and another group on the other side? And why, on balance, does there seem to be a trend toward secularism? It's not dramatic, but it's over a long enough period of time, and it's substantial enough to look at it and say, the United States seems to be moving in that direction. In Europe, that movement has been very dramatic. The question is, well, how similar is the United States really, or how different, based on some of the confusion in the polling data, but at a minimum, there's something there that shows that, I think, that kind of trend. And the other question that I think we want to get into as best we can is, how do these changes in the religious landscape correlate with cultural changes that are occurring outside the world of religion itself over the same period of time? Because we may find that there is something important beyond just the sociological data on the religions themselves that affects our thinking about this picture. So these are the kind of things we're going to explore next week. For today, the rest of our time is for discussion and questions. I want to give a big thank you to Jennifer for turning my scribblings into a PowerPoint presentation. And also catching all sorts of issues in the content along the way. Like, Preston, this doesn't really make sense, you know, like that. Along with a big thank you to Jim Hall and Karen Richardson and Margaret for help with the logistics for this. This was an interesting experiment, doing one of these between the two services. It's a kind of a dead stick landing, as the pilots would say, but I think it worked pretty well. Okay, it's your turn to talk. Raga, you were the first one out of the box. Do we have somebody running mics?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Thanks, Les.
Well, I'm not sure, but my understanding of church relates to Christianity. The sign in front of our building say university, universalist, it doesn't mention church.
Raga, hold the microphone up high. Yeah.
The sign in front of our building, our entrance, does not say the word church. It says university, universalist. And I'm wondering if this is a church or it is not. If it is not what it is, we are. I beg your answer.
Well, yeah, in 25 words or less, Susan says. Well, that certainly sets the table, doesn't it, that question. Raga, there is a long discussion that's gone on in this church about the word church, this thing that I call a church, about the word church. And there are people here who know a lot of that early history. Linda Lane Hamilton is certainly one, and other founders who were here at the very beginning, and other people that have come along the way. It's a pretty big discussion for us to get into. I think the short answer for me to give you is that there probably are some different views among the congregation about the word church, and what it might say about diversity and inclusiveness if the word church were used or not used. Some people think it might have a negative impact on that. Other people think it really wouldn't have an impact on that. And that's the state of play about that question. It's not part of the official name. So you're reading right what you see on the sign. But there is that conversation that has gone on and occasionally is resumed on the subject of whether we call ourselves a church, whether we are a church, what does it mean to be a church. I really love that word, ecclesia, that if you were at the 9 o'clock service, you heard me using, even though it's Greek and sounds a little fancy. It captures something really quite wonderful about the early churches and how non-sclerotic they were as institutions. They were really wonderfully alive. People called out to do something really, really grand and really special. Who else wants to get in here? Susan. And then Natalie.
Something I learned early about being a UU, being a fifth generation UU, kids, when I was growing up, would ask, you know, what church you go to, whatever. And they'd look at me like, huh? Oh, that's the church that doesn't believe anything and you don't have to go if you don't want to. Do you have Sunday school? Well, what do you do in Sunday school? Play? So this is some of the image that our religion has in this country, anyway, among the Christian, Protestant, and particularly Catholic religions.
Natalie?
I'd be very interested to look at the data as given by the churches instead of as given by the people. When I decided to stop being a Catholic, I wondered if there was some kind of process to resign or take my name off or send a letter to the last church I attended, because I probably am still being counted as a Catholic, even though I belong to this church, and they would probably still keep me because I have not sent them my resignation letter.
Yeah.
I've written some things on my blog that say, like, I quit. If anyone's out there, take my name off. I don't know if that counts, though.
Well, it's kind of like Chicago machine politics, isn't it? A little bit. The big institutional groups that do this kind of sociological work want to ask people directly, because with all the limitations even of that, when people self-identify, self-report, that's not necessarily perfectly accurate either. But the church institutional roles and numbers tended to be just very unreliable, and it doesn't necessarily mean conscious exaggeration. It could also just mean people don't get around to cleaning up the statistics or whatever, but the people like Pew Research Foundation, Pew Forum, they really wanted to get away from that, so they surveyed 35,000 people, which is a huge survey. Even though it seems small in relation to the country, it's really huge. So that's what I know about that. Nan?
I noticed that the worldwide population for UUs was 635,000, but ours is in this country it's only 200 and something. What's the where are the UUs in the rest of the world?
The 635,000 figure that I'm familiar with is probably a United States figure for identification, not participation. The worldwide figure for identification and the U.S. figure wouldn't be that different, because the number of UUs outside the United States is very small. A small number in Japan, in India, and in the United Kingdom, and then the rest is really a diaspora. But the 218 figure that you see in some places is membership. So what you're looking at there is U.S. membership versus U.S. or mostly U.S. participation. And one of the interesting messages about that for leadership of organized religion, including UU organized religion, is if there's 635,000 people who call themselves Unitarians, how come only a third of them want to come see what you're doing on Sunday? Ouch. So that, you know, there could be a lot of explanations for that too, but that's what those two numbers are about. Linda?
I'm one of a number of people of my age in this church who raised our children to be Unitarian Universalists, and they aren't. And I bet if we would, right, and I'm looking at people that recognize this, and I think as a denomination, we've done a great disservice to families who have been serious about wanting their children to remain in the church and have not. The other thought I had was that if we have this drop-off of membership in mainline and more open churches, and this increase in membership in evangelical, Mormon, and Jehovah's Witnesses, those are the people who are organized enough for political emphasis and political lobbying, and in a sense, we're giving a small group of people a much wider voice in our political process.
Who else would like to say something, ask a question, get into the discussion here?
I've never thought of us as the church. We are a gathering of people. Mm-hmm. We are not stuck in a dogma. Mm-hmm. When you think of church, you immediately think of rigid. Mm-hmm. I've never thought of us as a church. We have always been a congregation in my mind.
Okay, Raga, this is in a way kind of a further contribution to the question that you raised about how various people feel in the church about this question of feeling the what in the it's like the, you know, the artist formerly known as Prince, whatever it is.
Yeah.
In the quote church, unquote. Okay. Joe, and then somebody else was back here, Tracy also.
One of the things that has been talked about over the last several years, especially as we've been doing pledge campaigns and reaching out to people within our community, is the turnover rate that exists in congregations. And I recall last year reading something that came out, I think, from UUA, that the turnover rate within the Unitarian population in the United States was like 30% over a period of 3 years, which would suggest that a great many people come into the church, perhaps don't stay a long time. I was wondering, in the statistics that you were looking at about the decline, about the shifts that take place, I mean, for an example, the people who were originally in the Catholic tradition, where have they gone? Have they just dropped into the non churched group, or have they elected to choose other denominations or other kinds of congregations? And similarly with the Unitarians, as you said, if only one-third are coming, does some of that reflect switches to other denominations, other faiths, other kinds of movements?
Yeah, on the Unitarian piece of it, the Unitarian absolute numbers on membership are going up slightly, but not as a percentage of the population. So there is that statistic cited about revolving door rates, churn rates, whatever you might want to call it, in Unitarian Universalism and in other churches. The Pew Forum study did have a substantial section on this kind of migration, and I didn't take up our time today with getting into the details of that, but there are a couple things to notice. One is it's pretty clear where the net switching is going out of Protestantism, mainline Protestantism, and Catholicism. It's going into the unaffiliated category because that's the one where the really, really big growth is. So that's mainly where, you know, where that's going. The other thing that I can tell you, if we did go into this whole set of tables and studies that they had on the migration rates, that what we would see is that the overall rate of migration generically is just up all over the place. It's like a big, broad trend that people stay in one church far less than they used to, and not just one church geographically, one denomination. There are people who, substantial numbers who switched among Protestant denominations. All sorts of that kind of thing going on. I'm not sure what to make of that. You could read it as a kind of consumerist trend. You know, I don't like what's on offer here. They have a better salad bar at the Presbyterian Church down the street, whatnot. So we can speculate about some of that. But I think there's something to be said in the general kind of destabilizing picture of everything moving very fast, people making these changes a lot of migration back and forth. I think that's saying something important culturally. Tracy, and then you got somebody? Microphone. Who's got the microphone? Oh, you got Franz. Okay. Franz, just go ahead.
I think the explanation of why there's so few people attending in Unitarian, why only one-third of the people who designate themselves Unitarians are actually attending, is pretty natural. I mean, it comes from my experience, and I bet from many of our experiences. I was very active in it when I was in high school, but for some reason the high school group got me. And then I was very busy, and I felt very satisfied by what I had learned. It really set me on the right course. And then when I got old enough to have time to come back, or maybe worried enough to do something else, I came back, another way of saying this is that I think our impact may be far greater than our numbers. I mean, this is discouraging to us. We'd like to have people here to help us do this, but I think our impact may be very great. The very nature of what we teach is that it can have a huge impact for a short time. You go off and then live your life influenced by that and continue your search largely on your own. Of course, you need to come back. You should come back periodically, be renewed, but it may be inevitably the problem we face, that what we teach is doesn't have to be done right here.
Yeah. I think that point is just a very important overall point to keep in mind about the sociological data. There's all sorts of qualitative differences kind of lurking down underneath the quantitative data, and Franz sort of put his finger on one right there. A related one is that, the philosophy of education in Unitarian Universalism, and I may ask Margaret to chime in on this, since she just walked in. You know, Sophia Foss's view was, don't teach children denominationalism. Teach them about religion and spirituality generically. And then when they get to the right age to choose a denomination, trust that they'll do that wisely. So we believe in that philosophy, and a lot of other denominations are extremely insecure about making sure they grab their children early. And I think the prevailing view in that I've heard in Unitarian Universalist religious education is the notion that you're going to grab those kids and control them is, you know, kind of an illusion anyway. I don't think that means that there aren't better things we can do. You may have read about some of the big problems with YRUU nationally that the denomination has gone through and things like that. There are a lot of big problems there. But there is a philosophical backdrop there to keep in mind as well in terms of our educational philosophy. Eva, yes. Okay.
I wanted to kind of piggyback on something somebody else said about political clout.
Speak up.
Can you hear me better?
Yeah.
Okay. When I read the article about the Pew Research Fund, I think I was taken aback by the fact that it was only 3-4% evangelical population. And I thought, wow, but the political clout, you wouldn't imagine that. And I just wanted to share something and see what kind of feedback you give. You know, we see that here in town, we saw what happened when, with the school division, we ran into a little snafu about an outside group, not even local parents, who wanted to have a meeting in the schools, and they tried to charge them a fee, and it kind of backfired on them. So they have to allow them equal access to the school group, you know, which is okay. So political clout, using the law. It was interesting at open house the other night, just because groups are allowed in, like YMCA, I turn around, there's a table right there with a nice book, Is Jesus Your Shepherd? At my daughter's open house in the elementary school. Quite interesting. So right there, I mean, I was a little shocked, but they have their rights. They're a group. They're open. So just like Girl Scouts were allowed. So Jesus Camp, if you haven't seen it, quite wide open. Political clout, you know, using the law. So small population. So when you talk about the polarization between evangelical and secularization, I felt like, you know, the two magnets that push you apart, even if I was in the middle, here this one all of a sudden wanted to ram me to the other side, just because when you see like this, and I see this, of course you're going to have polarization, because when one goes here, what other option do you have except a reaction? So I just kind of wanted to throw that out.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Up here, up front, Eva.
I just have a couple of quick thoughts to add, and that's in regard to people coming for a short time and then leaving a service because they're not interested. It speaks to our whole mentality as a fast food nation. Very short attention span. Lack of tolerance or patience in trying new things and working through the process. And it's just a cultural, I think, that's taken hold, a cultural idea that's taken hold of Americans and maybe the larger world, and it's really hard to fight that sort of trend. The other idea I've had in your presentation, Preston, and in the following discussion is that we might benefit by looking at the success that some of the groups have achieved and using those ideas and those mechanisms or tools within our own framework and moving in that direction. Mm-hmm. Often you can learn the best from your quote-unquote opponent, mm-hmm. and copy, emulate the opponent's success by using those ideas.
Yes. Yes, you very much can do that. Shall we just try John here and then go back to Larry? And
well, I just wanted to quickly express a sort of minority opinion that it's important that we survive, yes, but I mean, we want to be here for the people who are of like minds, and growth isn't necessarily a good thing if you're changing yourself in the process, or if the people who aren't joining us are joining something that's more valuable to them.
Yeah, I think that perspective ought to be held up. I think it's very valid, John. We don't want to be growth at any cost, I'm sure. And I know you weren't saying that.
No.
Yeah. Larry, back here somewhere? Who do we... Les, do you have somebody over here? Oh, you. He's so polite. He's got the microphone in his hand. Go ahead.
I don't know who has the action now. I think a lot of us probably belong to what John Shelby Spong relates to the Christian... Alumni Association. And my guess is another analogy that a lot of the, in terms of migration, it's almost like an escalator. people start at one level, the escalator will only take them to a certain level, then you hop off and get to another escalator, and go on and on. And my guess is a lot of those in the Christian Alumni Society haven't found the next level of their escalator. But my real question is, I was really fascinated by the agrarian, industrial, post-industrial, and I'm wondering what we know about what the post-industrial people say they don't need that leads them to this action.
Well, that's going to be the big question for session two, because there's some more data. You'll be disappointed to learn it won't be quite as saturating as today's was, but there are some studies that look particularly at income and economic security in relation to religious participation. And that's a very big topic of discussion in sociology of religion. And I have Larry Venice to thank for tipping me off to a wonderful book that did all the brushwork that I never possibly could have done, that pulled together a lot of information on that, called Sacred and Secular by Pippa Norris and one other author. And we'll be talking about that. You're putting your finger on a really big issue. Is there an economic explanation for what's going on here or something else? There are other competing theories, too. With other people back here, Larry? And then.
I just wanted to make a comment from the field of psychology of religion, which is, as everyone would assume, our ability to think and think complexly increases as we gain experience and increase in age. And for many denominations, they present a model of the world and a model of religion that's a very concrete and literal model which fits with young children's thinking. And when those same children get to adolescence, they think differently and they reject that model without knowing that there are alternative perspectives on religion.
I'd like to just offer a thought about raising kids. I'm interested in the shift toward unaffiliated folks. I was raised in a mainstream Methodist church, and I even sang with a Presbyterian group that was probably would be considered evangelical in this day and age. But I increasingly was questioning things myself, and now I have a hard time raising my kids and saying, Jesus is the way and the truth and the life, because I look around and our country is so diverse now, and not just that, but just I think the increase in the amount of information that the children are exposed to. I mean, like I talked to my 10-year-old son, and he says, well, Mommy, I don't believe in God. What about the Big Bang? And I'm thinking, I don't think I knew what the Big Bang was when I was 10. Yeah. And I'm hard-pressed to answer that question.
Yeah.
So I just think it's interesting. Like, there's so much more information out there and just, access to information for children. They're questioning, well, how do we explain God when the Big Bang's out there? What does that mean?
Yeah, this is the first generation for whom the big issue is not how to get information, it's how to screen it out. For those of us who are older, we grew up thinking, how am I going to get the information for the report I need to do? Now it's, how can I filter a lot of this junk out because there's so much of it? We're just about out of time here. We should wrap up. Does somebody want to have the last word here? Margaret would like to have the last word. Perfect. We didn't set that up.
So I was not here for a lot of this discussion, but I can tell that there was a very rich discussion going on, and I want to give you a way to continue it. We have created an online version of this class in the Moodle section. You didn't know this, but we have Moodle, which is, if any of you have used Blackboard, it's how online learning occurs. And you can just go on to the website and put in /Moodle, and I have the instructions here, and you can post discussion questions, and it's a way for these discussions to continue in an online environment, since clearly we won't have time for all the questions here. And I have these bright, beautiful pink sheets that tell you how to enroll in the class. And I am available to answer your questions about enrolling.
So as we were saying, the world really is changing a lot. Thank you all very much. See you next week.